desk and then I'm going to get this to move forward. Just push this button.
Yes.
Okay. Good afternoon. Again, my name is Shakira Washington. Today, the title of my presentation is Assessing Behavioral HIV Risk Factors Among Black Women Who Report Recent Sex Partners with a History of Incarceration, Implications for Targeted HIV Prevention or Prevention Interventions. Now, I was told that I was actually supposed to include my presenter disclosure on my presentation, so here it is. I have no relationships to disclose. Just a little bit of background. Again, at the time that this data was collected, I was working with a community-based organization called Community Education Group. The website is there underneath the name. The founder and executive director is A. Tony Young. The organization was established in 1993, and its primary focus is on HIV and AIDS and women. Their programming includes social marketing, technical assistance, research advocacy, as well as education and awareness programs, mostly at the community-based level. So now, why this particular presentation? As you all know, this is really a repeat of much of the information and data that you all probably already know, but I'll just go through it very briefly because I don't want to run out of time. In 2005, African Americans basically accounted for 13% of the population, yet accounted for about 50% of all estimated cases of HIV and AIDS. Among black women in 2005, of all the cases among women, African American women accounted for approximately 64% of all women living with HIV and AIDS. It was one of the leading causes of death, and at that time, and continuing, the primary mode of transmission is high-risk heterosexual contact. Now, there are a number of reasons and speculations about why HIV and AIDS is so high among African-American populations, and these are just some of the reasons: poverty, unknown partner status and risk behaviors, rates of sexually transmitted diseases, the social networks that we move within, and as of late, a growing concern about rates of incarceration. So why are we concerned about incarceration and HIV and AIDS? One, the biggest factor is that the number of inmates has more than tripled since the 1980s, with the primary reason being the war on drugs, which began in the 80s. African Americans have been incarcerated nearly six times the rate of whites. And what is important about this is that individuals who are being incarcerated are, before actually entering the system, are already at high risk due to high-risk sexual and substance abusing behaviors prior to incarceration. It's also been speculated that the prevalence of HIV and AIDS within our prison systems is actually five times higher than the general population, which puts individuals at increased risk once they're actually in. You know, there are a number of things just in terms of HIV stigma, fear of violence, isolation, and possible targeting due to status. It prevents many inmates from either disclosing their status or actually even wanting to know their status. So high-risk behaviors that actually continue within the prison systems actually put individuals at greater risk of infection. There's definitely information about continued consensual as well as non-consensual sexual acts occurring within our prisons, sharing of drug and tattooing paraphernalia, and also a continuous cycle of individuals in and out of our prison systems. Now, it has been estimated that somewhere between 20 to 25% of our U.S. HIV-infected population is released from prison each year. Once released, their biggest priority becomes reintegration into society. Unfortunately, due to a lack of consistent and continuous care and programs for individuals being released, other priorities begin to take place other than, you know, taking care of their health. So they're worried about financial stability, housing, finding housing, as well as reestablishing relationships that they once had in the communities that they originally came from. So this lack of continuous care and programming not only puts them at greater risk of greater health risk, but it also puts their social and sexual networks at risk as well. Now, this data that I'm actually going to present today, again, we were part of the first round of MARI recipients. We were awarded the three-year cooperative agreement. The original study actually focused on African-American men and women and their willingness to participate in HIV preventive vaccine clinical trials. And it was focused on identifying various facilitators and barriers, the factors that actually affect willingness to participate. Many of these factors included knowledge about preventive clinical trials, historical distrust variables such as Tuskegee, as well as other HIV context and trial-related variables. Two sites, as Madeline had mentioned, were originally awarded. That was CEG, or Community Education Group in Washington, D.C., as well as Jackson State University in Jackson, Mississippi. And then a third site was added on the California Prevention and Education Program in Oakland, California. Now, to be eligible for the study, an individual had to, one, self-identify as being Black or African American, or at least having some heritage in which they self-identified. They had to be between the ages of 18 to 70. They had to provide a zip code within the three targeted areas, and they had to be willing and able to provide informed consent. Furthermore, they actually had to meet the most basic of eligibility requirements for an HIV preventive vaccine clinical trial. Basically, they had to be HIV negative, they had to be of relatively good health, they had to be willing to take an HIV test, and they had to have had no prior history and participation in a clinical trial. Now, we use a convenience sampling methodology to recruit individuals into the study. We put out all stops to recruit folks. We sent out flyers, we had referrals, we connected with health and social service agencies, we went to shelters, halfway houses, bars, clubs, various community events. Once an individual was found to be eligible, the primary survey was self-administered through an ACASI system. So in total, we enrolled just a little bit over 1,500 individuals, and of those individuals, 903 were females and 637 were males. Now, the goal of this particular analysis is actually really to look at one particular question of interest, and this question was actually only administered to females who were participating in the study. And the question was, in the past year, have you had sex with a man who recently got out of jail or prison? And my interest was in comparing those who said yes and those who said no. And I wanted to look at them in terms of a few demographic characteristics, their perceptions about risk for infection, as well as HIV-related behavioral risk factors. These particular factors were assessed using basically asking the women, in the previous 3 months, have you been involved in any of the following types of behaviors? Injecting drugs, smoking crack cocaine, having sex with an injection drug user, as well as number of sex partners, and of those sex partners, the number that were of unknown HIV status. So just in general, just in terms of the fallout of the female population, we probably pulled about one-third, about a third came from each area that we actually were pulling data from, Washington, D.C., and Jackson, and Oakland. And it also pretty much fell out fairly evenly as well in terms of looking at the two groups of women that we'll be looking at today. So the first demographics, basically I wanted to look at five specific demographics. The first two, which is age and marital status. These demographic variables actually were not different between these two groups that we'll be looking at today. The mean age was 38 with a standard deviation of 12. We had a nice representation across most of the age categories, with 18 to 25 being the least and the majority being in the age cohort of 36 and 45 years of age. What I think is really interesting about this particular data is that given that approximately 80% of our sample population stated that they were 26 years of age and older, you would actually expect a larger number of individuals to say that they were actually married. However, if you look at the marital status, well over 80% of our participants were either single, divorced, separated, widowed, or considered other. So while it's nice to know that our female sample population actually is representative of much of the national statistics, it's still really quite interesting in terms of the data that such a large percentage would be unmarried. Now, the next demographic that I was interested in looking at was with regards to educational attainment within our sample population. And as you can see, just overall, educational attainment among the sample population is very low. Only 13% of this cohort reported continuing their education after high school, with the remaining 87% reporting a high school diploma or less. Now, when comparing our sample population based on the two groups of interest, we found that the disparities increased significantly. It was found that women who reported a sexual partner with a history of incarceration were less likely to report higher levels of educational attainment. For example, 36% of this population reported receiving less than a high school diploma as compared to 23% of their counterpart. Fewer members of this group, or 56%, reported receiving a high school diploma versus 62% of the comparison group, and only 7% of this group compared to 15% of the comparison group reported attending school beyond high school. Now, the next slide is regarding employment. Overall, we have what I like to consider or coin as an underemployed population, sample population, with only about 27% actually reporting that they were employed full-time at the time of this study. The remaining 73% were either unemployed, working part-time, self-employed students, or reporting that their employment status was other. And as with educational attainment, employment disparities increased significantly when comparing the two groups of interest. Women reporting, oh, wow, that was fast. Okay, so I'm going to have to move along very quickly. Okay, so as we can see, basically this disparity actually increased significantly when we began looking at the comparison groups. 58% of the women reporting incarcerated partners were unemployed in comparison to 49% of women reporting, not reporting incarcerated partners. So I'm going to have to sort of really jump through very, very quickly because I was already given a five-minute sign and I have several slides, unfortunately, left. When it comes to income disparities, again, this particular sample population is definitely very impoverished. It was reported just overall about 57% of the overall population actually earned $10,000 or less annually. Now, when we look at our comparison groups, we find that women who report sexual partners with a history of incarceration, 63% of this population earns less than $10,000 annually, compared to 55% for the comparison group. So basically, in summary, you know, there's definitely a disparity in terms of looking at their economic status in terms of educational attainment, income, as well as employment status. Now, the other thing that I want to do was look at how these two groups compare in terms of reporting of their risk factors. As you can see, women who report incarcerated partners are at a significantly increased risk for reporting things such as crack cocaine use, exchanging sex for necessities, sex with a partner with an STD or STI, as well as sex with an intravenous drug user, having had an STD, and actually injecting. And what was interesting about this data is that actually injection drug use was the least reported risk factor among the female cohort, whereas crack cocaine, exchanging sex, and having sex with someone with an STD were the top three. Now, the other thing that we asked was, how many men have you had sex with in the past 3 months? We also found a significant difference between these two populations. Women with incarcerated partners tended to have more sexual partners in comparison to the comparison group. And we also found that of the number of people that they had actually reported, that they had higher numbers that were of unknown status, which is that bottom table below. Now, one of the things in terms of perceptions of risk for HIV infection, we wanted to look at these two groups to see if their perceptions were any different. And unfortunately, as with national data, what we're seeing here is that the majority of women in general believe that they're at low risk for infection. But this, I found that this was actually kind of interesting because women who were engaged in other high-risk behaviors women who had incarcerated partners actually believed that they were at increased risk for infection. So, there is something that seems to be going on that perhaps there is you know, some difference in perceptions of risk, which is somewhat positive, even though obviously there's still some disparities in terms of what, you know, perception and behavior. And unfortunately, this did not translate into condom use. As you can see, close to, I guess it's close to about 70% of individuals who did not report incarcerated partners, and about a little over 80% of those who reported incarcerated partners simply are not using condoms consistently. There's a very low percentage who are saying that they always use condoms. So that continues to be a problem within this particular cohort. Now, I'm actually going to skip this slide. This just sort of looks at the last two slides that I presented, but it only looks at women, the 199 people who actually reported having an incarcerated partner. And it kind of splits up these two groups in terms of, you know, whether that was their only risk factor or if they had other risk factors occurring, and kind of looks at their perceptions of risk as well as condom use. But I actually have copies of my slides if anybody's interested in getting a copy. So in summary, in terms of this particular study, about 22% of our sample population reported partners with a history of incarceration. There are definite disparities in education and employment and income levels. In terms of high-risk behaviors, they're much more likely to engage in these types of behaviors. Perceptions of risk continues to be low regardless of risk status. Just in general, African-American women continue to feel that they're at low risk. In terms of targeted interventions, which I think is really important, one, we need to definitely push to have more interventions put into our jails and prison systems, whether it's increased testing or providing more preventative measures within our prison and jail systems. And we also, I believe, need to really begin to connect our interventions that are happening in our prison systems and among men with their social networks outside. Is it, from this particular data, it does appear that there is there are some definite risk factors going on within the female population that also need attention. And given their connections with one another, they should be incorporated and included together. So that's my quick last 5 minutes. And I'd like to, you know, thank obviously the CDC and so on and so forth.
Thank you. Thank you. I finished in the last 5 minutes. Yes, you did. Okay, thank you, Shakira, for keeping that going. We're going to move right ahead to Dr. Sylvia Amnesty. Dr. Amnesty is going to be talking some about her project that's going to look at the possibility of HIV testing at pharmacies in New York City. Dr. Amnesty is an assistant professor of clinical medicine at Columbia University, and she's also a research fellow at the New York Academy of Medicine. Dr. Amnesty.